Welcome to the Greener Way podcast, a show about people, planet, and purpose, and how investors and corporate leaders push forward in a complex world.
On this episode of The Greener Way, we're talking about sustainability and intersectionality with Kylie Porter, Group Head of Sustainability, Sunrise Group. Kylie's worked across a wide variety of organizations, but always at that nexus of the E, the S, and the G in sustainability. And she's someone I've been talking with for a really long time. Kylie, welcome to The Greener Way.
Thanks, Rachel.
Kylie, you've had a wide-ranging career in sustainability, like I said in the intro, across government, NGO, and the corporate sector. Can you walk us through your experiences and tell us what's the through line on sustainability for you?
Sure. So I've been in sustainability for about 20 years, and I guess in some respects I fell into it. I was working for ANZ on their graduate program and was fortunate enough to be involved in some of the discussions that were happening across the bank on how do you assess risk or credit risk in particular when a bank is financing things in, for example, the forestry industry or mining, et cetera. So it really sparked my interest in the role that corporates can play in improving life for people and for the planet. I ended up moving over to the UK and I worked for Standard Chartered, which is a very large financial institution. It's got specific focus on Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. So it was quite an interesting organization to work for. Its head office is in London, but at the time it really had no retail presence whatsoever in London. And I worked in corporate affairs, specifically in relation to environmental communications. And to put it in perspective about how far we've come, this was back in the day where my role was really about getting people to turn off the light when they left a meeting room, print double-sided or don't print at all. Things that seem very rudimentary today when I speak about it. And as that role progressed, I ended up working in their wholesale banking division, effectively implementing what I was part of at ANZ. So looking at all these position statements that Standard Chartered had on a variety of industries and becoming the conduit for the bank in between the actual business, so the wholesale banking or institutional banking arm, and a range of international NGOs. And so that really opened my eyes to the different ways in which people can respond, or, you know, companies in particular can respond to it. And I think for me, one of the pivotal ones was at the time Standard Chartered had provided finance to a gas pipeline in northern Russia, which, God forbid that we should talk about Russia these days, but it was for this, what's called the Sakhalin 2 project, which was around providing a gas pipeline to give Japan some energy security. And WWF UK in particular had huge concerns, rightly so, with this project around the impact on particularly migrant whale species, but a range of other ones. And I sat in the nexus of the of WWF and the business and what was right, and the theory that if Standard Chartered didn't fund this deal and have a range of ESG requirements built into the contract, that it would fall to the wayside and another bank, potentially one from Eastern Europe that didn't have the same ESG credentials, would control this deal and therefore potentially add to worse outcomes for particularly for the environmental impact. And through that negotiation, WWF stopped protesting for Standard Chartered for starters, but they became really heavily involved in how we went about making those environmental assessments. So came onto site, looked at the project, consulted really closely with the bank on it. And I think for me, that's been the, well, I think you use the word, you know, through line in terms of my career, because from that point onwards, I went to work for in FMCG and manufacturing for a bit. I then went and worked for KPMG and human rights consulting. And I also worked for Save the Children in Australia, doing a very similar role, advising their exec on how do you form partnerships. So under the Aid Plus Trade agenda that the Australian government had at the time, how do you form partnerships with corporates to give strong development outcomes without it questioning the integrity of an international NGO? And then worked for National Australia Bank, or NAB, again, running stakeholder engagement as that conduit between consumer advocacy organisations, activist organisations, investor relations groups, et cetera, on mm-hmm. that ESG space. And then before I moved into my current role, I was executive director of the UN Global Compact Network Australia, so the Australian local network of the United Nations Global Compact. And again, if I look back on my time there, that through line was the stakeholder engagement. I could not have grown the network. I could not have grown the programming if it wasn't for a really strong understanding of the stakeholders that sit in that remit. So, you know, I could talk about through lines being climate. You know, unfortunately, climate action has been just a consistent theory, you know, line straight throughout. Embedding human rights has been throughout. But ultimately, for me, I think people who do sustainability well are very good at stakeholder engagement and navigating that pathway.
We love a bit of, I often talk about this, I bang on about this incessantly, that, you know, to me, sustainability really sort of embodies that, you know, that Carl Olinsky organizing model of being one foot in and one foot out. And it's interesting where you see sustainability professionals that have traded that, you know, gone NGO, corporate, government, and how to organize people and you know, put ideas together. It's an interesting study, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
So given all of that as prelude, Kylie, how has the consideration of sustainability evolved in recent years? You know, like I can remember I was laughing a little bit when you said, you know, some of the early work was, you know, encouraging people to turn out the lights and print double-sided. And now we're looking at ways to embed, you know, net zero responsibilities throughout organizations, for example. But so how have things changed? And then how does this impact on strategies within organizations?
Things have changed so rapidly to the point where I think if you asked anyone in that chief sustainability officer type role, it's at the point of being overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think some things haven't changed, right? Like action on climate change and the fact that corporates have a big role to play in investing in solutions that will reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. That has not changed. Mm-hmm. But the technical understanding that sits underneath that has just gone leaps and bounds. So when I started, there is no way you would consider hiring a climate scientist, right? Like carbon accounting wasn't even really a thing when I started. And now like, Sunrise is in the process of setting its science-based target, and when it gets submitted, we will be one of few organisations or companies, I should say, globally that have set a target against what they call FLAG, so forestry, land and agricultural use emissions, and non-FLAG. Now, I am not and never have professed to be great at science and math, but I have had to give myself a really quick lesson on how to understand things like emissions reduction factors and how we've gone about globally calculating what the emissions are from sowing rice to wheat to soya, right? Like that level of detail we've never had before from a business. And so that piece alone has just had significant, you know, leaps and bounds in ways to try and support the Paris Agreement around 1.5. When I started, there was, in corporate sustainability, there was definitely an understanding of human rights. And a lot of them at the time, those understandings were embedded in the International Labour Organization standards, you know, the ILO. But in my time, the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights have come out. The OECD guidelines on multinational enterprises has expanded into a range of different areas. The expectations on a corporate to understand what an effective grievance mechanism is when there is a human rights issue, and what the role a corporate has or a business has to play in remedy, those things weren't around then. And then you overlay that with the Modern Slavery Act in Australia, and you know, for global organisations, similar acts that are already in place or are coming in. The massive shifts in Europe. And then again, things like packaging. and the considerations. So I think the change is just, it's almost unwieldy. You know, I must say that it is incredibly challenging in these sorts of roles to stay on top of what's happening in what space. And that's where I think it's actually really important to admit as a CSO that you are never going to be the expert on all of this. You know, you need a really strong, decent enough size team for the size of the company you're working with. You need space in your day to read. And when you overlay that, I should say, with reporting, I mean, you know, sustainability reports, go and have a look at them from 20 years ago, even in the mining sector, which is probably the most advanced of the lot.
Yeah.
Just the change in reports and the change that we're going to see now with ISSB coming in is just phenomenal. I don't think we quite appreciate, or I think a lot of people in businesses don't quite appreciate the complexity of what sustainability covers. But I think we're still grappling in a lot of organisations, and I say a lot of organisations through the lens of previously being the executive director of the UN Global Compact. A lot of organisations don't still see it as value adding. It's still seen as a bit of a cost centre, still seen as the area that can to some extent mitigate risk. But the organisations that do this incredibly well are the ones that, to be crass about it, put their money where their mouth is and start.
Yeah.
And put in big investment dollars into research and development and new technologies, or, you know, they take the hit to put renewable energy, you know, into all of their operations. But I mean, we could spend hours just talking about the change in the last 20 years, and I still don't think we would cover all of it, Rachel. I really don't.
Well, and I mean, the optimistic thing about it is that, you know, it's the bar is constantly rising. You know, my I remember story is, you know, I was a journalist in London in 2002 and 2003, and I went to this weird press conference for an organization called Carbon Disclosure Project and came back, and my editor said, well, you can have 150 words because who cares about how companies disclose carbon emissions?
That's okay. When I moved into sustainability, I had a few people in sort of my parents' generation be like, you sure that's a sensible move? Like, isn't that a really big risk taking a role in that area? It's still not going to be around, is it? So completely get it.
But the irony of nature of it, that as soon as there's a standard that is reached, there's a group of people who are demanding for higher performance. And so, to that extent, hopefully we never catch the tail on sustainability, because that means, you know, we're not looking at what the next risk or what the next opportunity is, from my perspective.
I agree.
So one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, Kylie, is because I wanted to talk, again, we've been talking about this intersection between human rights and climate, and the need to consider the environmental and the human rights together, not separately. What has your experience shown about this?
I still think we're at the start of this one. I don't, I wouldn't say that I've seen there's no company or organization that automatically springs to mind as, yes, you have worked out how to manage that nexus. And I think we talk about it broadly, right? So, for instance, I think we inherently know that most Pacific Islands are going to really, really suffer from climate change. And the inevitable outcome, unfortunately, of that is that we are going to have an influx, not necessarily just in Australia, but in surrounding countries, of climate change refugees. And so that environmental impact causing a direct impact on people. We also know that when you expose people to vulnerable situations like that, that it also opens up, unfortunately, the probability of those people being held in slave-like conditions. Right. So we have a broad sort of understanding that that's potentially a risk. It interests me that we have only really just started to notice this one, particularly given the years of lockdowns under COVID. But that intersection between climate change and health is a really big human rights risk. And during my tenure with GCNA, we actually started writing a report on the intersection of climate change and health. I think we started writing it a good 6 months before anyone even knew about COVID, and it got released just, I think, maybe a month or so before lockdowns. Mm. And things like coronaviruses and other viruses are going to significantly increase with climate mm-hmm. change. But we're not talking about how that's going to impact our workforce. Right? We hear a lot about flexibility and work from home and things like that, but we don't put mm-hmm. it in the context of we are going to have health issues that are impacted by higher temperatures. How mm-hmm. are we going to manage that in our workforce? What needs to change in the way in which we engage with our employees to ensure that we're mm-hmm. managing that? The same goes mm-hmm. with things like sport. What's going to be the impact on sport as we know it? And that could be, you know, I've got a huge love of AFL. Well, mm. if winter is going to get a lot hotter, are they still going to play then? But also mm-hmm. what's been the impact on the women's AFL who play later in the year mm-hmm. and originally were playing over the summer months? There was, you know, cases of them playing on days where it was close to 40 degrees, you know, similar mm-hmm. to what you started to hear this year around the tennis. Mm-hmm. Is this actually right, playing tennis in Australia in late January? Mm. But I don't think we talk about that enough in terms of what those environmental impacts are going to be mm-hmm. on people. Mm-hmm. And then the other big one is, what's it going to do to livelihoods? So we hear more, particularly under the current government, around the just transition or the need for those you know, those larger entities that are going to manage that process as we transition away from fossil fuels. But mm-hmm. they have significant impacts on people. So unless you transition those communities, those regions well and find mm-hmm. like-for-like jobs for people who are there, you put in measures to help any environmental outcomes from the closure of the mine site, for example, or the power plant. Unless you do all of those things, we are going to leave people and communities behind. And that has that is obviously a significant human rights impact. Mm-hmm. So I think my view is almost any environmental impact is going to have some form of impact on people and potentially on people's human rights. You know, even mm-hmm. like a really great example from which I grapple with at the moment at Sunrise is we know that globally rice contributes an awful lot to greenhouse gas emissions through the release of methane in the sowing mm-hmm. process because generally speaking, you flood a rice paddy. So the way to reduce methane is to reduce the water on rice. And there are different techniques globally to do that. In Australia, when you reduce the water on rice, you're reducing irrigated water. So there's obviously environmental benefits to, for example, the Murray-Darling. There's environmental benefits in terms of just access to fresh water use. But it's impacting on the habitat of bitterns, which are an endangered species in Australia because they come to the rice paddies when they're covered uh-huh. in water. Right? Uh-huh. So there's that, you know, like anything in sustainability, you know, what the trade-off is.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you also have to say, if we reduce the amount of water on rice, can we still grow rice in Australia? What's the impact? You know, can we move to these other systems without impacting what are quite significant farming communities? So I think with sustainability and those nexuses like climate change and human rights, it's actually about being aware of the questions and asking not necessarily the right question, but mm-hmm. a whole series of questions that make you sort of ponder and think and then work out at which things are you prepared to trade off and what are the implications of those trade-offs, particularly the implications that you might not be thinking of. You know, those unintended consequences are so challenging in this world that we operate in.
Those unknown unknowns that only come up sort of, you know, 3, 5, 7 years down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I think someone the other day told me that paper packaging, whilst it removes plastic from the environment, which has obviously numerous benefits.
Yeah.
Paper packaging, actually, the production of paper packaging, and I haven't verified this, so don't assume that I'm 100% right. Apparently it uses more carbon emissions than plastic packaging.
Yep. Right, so it's like
these or constant
polar fleece. you know, polar fleece, which in the United States was a great, it helped transition mill towns and textile weaving in certain communities in the United States. But, you know, as it's turned out, you know, at the time it was sold as a great recycling and upcycling program. But as it's turned out, it's accelerated the impact of microplastics through the environment. And it's 20 years down the line.
Yeah.
These are the things, and these are the questions that well-intentioned people didn't have the scope to ask 20 years ago, and we're managing the trade-offs of that impact now.
Yeah, absolutely.
So with that in mind, as we now that we've discussed about how complex it is, you know, what the unknowns are, how do you actually start doing it? You having had this experience of a multiplicity of environments and currently doing it in your current role, how do companies start identifying what those key challenges are and how they can tackle them to, you know, minimize risk and increase profitability?
So I think the hard part is making sure that you've got the right team to do both, right? It's very easy in sustainability roles to focus on the risks when and as they arrive and then sort of leave the opportunity for later, so to speak. From my perspective, and I guess something that I'm trying to do here at Sunrise is you've got to integrate from the top. The sustainability strategy has to fold into the group's approach or the company's approach to what they do. So in the case of Sunrise, we're actually, most people don't realize, we're actually quite a complex business. We have effectively three different business units. So whilst Rice is the predominant business, we don't own any farms. So everything is post farm gate. But we also have a business that deals in ruminant feed and pet food, and then we have another business that's a gourmet food business, so a combination of European imports and local manufacturing. But understanding the synergies between those businesses has been a really big piece. So how do they operate that's similar? How do they operate in ways that are different? From the way that I've started to look at things here is we know that our scope 3 emissions, like every company, are the biggest, but we also know that of those emissions, the rice that we source and the rice grown in Australia, so the rice we source from 11 different countries globally and the rice sourced in Australia, they're where our emissions are. So for me, that's about working with our head of agribusiness to look at ways in which we can influence and advocate for practice change for growers, not only in Australia, but in some of our global markets as well, like Vietnam. It's about having really good idea about what our boundary looks like. So of all the things that we do across scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3, what is included in that? And when we then, and setting, I think setting a science-based target is an excellent way to understand that and to do that really thoroughly. And then talking to everyone in the business to find out, well, where are the levers? And then basing your strategy, your plan to net zero, or your near-term plan, whatever the priority might be for the business, on what's the low-hanging fruit and what are the things that we're prepared to invest in as a business, because we know that long-term it's going to get us to net zero. But not only that, it's going to give us opportunities for partnerships, or it's going to give us opportunities to do research and development into a new way of breeding rice, for example. And I think when you do something like that on the carbon side, you also get a good insight into other areas from an environmental perspective, right? So you get an understanding of what your packaging going to look like. And then it's the next step. Okay, so from a packaging perspective, what are the voluntary standards, or what are the global standards, and aligning things to that. So you know, for our Australia and New Zealand businesses, we are APCO members, but we also contribute to the National Plastics Recycling Scheme here. On the human rights side, I think this is, like I said about climate, it's so complex. And for me, in setting the approach, it's actually about taking a step back and looking at what is an adequate and good human rights framework that will support the business to make decisions that give better outcomes for people. So it's not just looking at it through the lens of modern slavery, which I think is what a lot of companies have gone down the pathway of, but what are the elements that link into human rights for our own people, for our operational sites, for our tier one suppliers, our co-manufacturing facilities, and beyond? And what are the opportunities to improve livelihoods for the people within our supply chain? And also, what are the things we need to put in place to manage that risk? So for me, it's been breaking down the social, breaking down the environmental into pieces, and then working that back up to an overall or framework of pillars around that that people, planet, governance, and then the things that are just generally expected of you that you have to do as BAU. And overall, I think anyone who's in these roles would know, like, doing a materiality review, even if you think you know the areas of materiality for your business, you don't really know until you invest time with all stakeholders to really get a good feel of that. So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all approach to strategy and how to do it. I think it's a building block, and you need to spend a lot of time talking to people in the business, including people in the business who probably don't understand sustainability in the same lens, or perhaps don't quite see the complexities and the trade-offs, and making sure that you're explaining that to them in a language that works with the area that they're responsible for. You know, the men and women working in our mills in, you know, the Riverina region of Australia, they're not thinking every day about the same things that I am. And you have to speak, you have to be able to adjust and speak. And that goes back to what we started with around stakeholder engagement. You need to be able to speak a language that other people are going to understand, and really stop assuming that, unfortunately, everyone, like, you know, everyone doesn't have something in the back of their head that every day they're going to do something that helps with climate action. You know, so look, again, I think there's so many amazing sustainability practitioners out there, and I think if you asked all of us, we'd probably have a slightly different approach, you know, to how we set up strategy and how we engage. But fundamentally, I think if you looked at any corporate sustainability strategy, it all leverages up, all feeds up to people, planet, governance, and what that foundational structure is that sits effectively underneath the house.
Excellent. And then, so Kylie, as we come to the end of our time together, what keeps you awake at night?
I have 4 children. So, you know, there's a lot that keeps me awake at night.
Oh, yeah. I empathize with that.
You know, it probably depends on it. It depends on a given week. I think what keeps me awake at night is what I don't know.
Yes.
It's that, you know, question that I don't know if I'll ever feel the answer to, but is there something that I have missed? You know, is there a piece of our approach or the work that we're doing that I should be prioritizing over something else, but I just don't know what it is? And what impact is that going to have on people or on the environment because I've missed it?
I know that feeling of the expanding edge of sustainability it extends out into infinity, even better, at the same pace as the universe.
It does. Yeah. It probably means we're going to be awake for a long period of time.
Yeah, I feel so. I feel so. Well, Kylie Porter, Group Head of Sustainability at Sunrise Group, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks for listening to the Greener Way podcast. If you liked today's show, remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform and make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss an episode. Any feedback? Contact us on podcast@fssustainability.com.au. I'm Rachel Allen Backus.
The Greener Way podcast is a product of FS Sustainability, a show about people, the planet, and investing in our collective future. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only.
The Greener Way podcast gives listeners access to information and educational content provided by discussing numerous financial sustainable options and our featured guests.
It is not intended as a substitute for professional, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of The Greener Way are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances.
FS Sustainability operates under an Australian Financial Service License and the exemption made available under the Corporations Act 2001 in respect to any information or advice given. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement, and if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional.
For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the FS Sustainability website, fssustainability.com.au.